Nerds at Irregular Hours, episode 172 for July 20th, 2021. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hassenflam.
And I'm Pam Vidor.
And we have reached the end of Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel, the post-pandemic story that we've been reading for the whole month of July, and we've reached the end of the pandemic. The pandemic is over, and boy, in this section of the book, we get so much pandemic, and then so many beautiful things that wrap up at the end of this story, huh?
The end is near.
The end of this book. The end of this book is near for sure.
The monster at the end of the book, right? Grover.
This final portion does really delve back into the pandemic in a way that we hadn't quite seen before. Again, I just love the way that she organizes the timeline. This really, really complex timeline. But I feel like she hits it exactly right.
I totally agree. This is not a time travel story, but it feels like a time travel story because of the out of order way that she is giving us this information. And we get all the information. We get so many emotions. We get so many feelings of how this all went down in this section this week.
It was enjoyable to kind of see the bow being wrapped up and kind of going through this story. This is a really good story.
It's a really, really good story, and it's beautifully told, right? I think this is, like, she hits it on both levels, that you're really interested and fascinated with, like, what happened to these people? But at the same time, like, I really couldn't imagine any changes. You know how sometimes when you do book club and you think, oh, I think it would have been better if they'd done this or this or this.
Really? In a book club, sometimes we second guess the author? Huh.
Not huh. Our book club. I'm just saying. Huh. I've heard of such things happening. But no, this is a story. This is a novel that I feel like I didn't have that sense. I just was like, wow. Wow.
Many of the characters we follow, we understand their motivations. We understand what they're going through. It's just like life. Every individual actor is moving into their own sort of world. But together, there is this movement that happens. Like how spontaneously the airport becomes the city.
How about that? Did you enjoy that, Chip, that we got to the airport and the airport is civilization as it stands after the pandemic?
Everything's at the airport, Steve. Everything's at the airport. There's even Chili's there.
That works, right? That works. In our real life, if we were stranded, the airport might be a source of all of the things that we need. There's kitchens there. There's food there. There's clothing there. There's shelter there. It has everything.
And because so much is going on at an airport, think about it. There's toilet paper and paper towels. And I mean, all those goods that you think they've got it in mass quantities. And then the airplanes have their own set of materials there too. So if you're going to have a pandemic, that's probably a good place to be.
And there's aviation fuel, which lasts so much longer than regular gas, as she tells us. And I think it's fascinating that we have this feeling of the airport, and we've met Clark a few times throughout, but then in this last portion of the book, we really get Clark's story. And I know I've been kind of asking you guys throughout, like, who's your favorite story? And I've been saying, my favorite story is Clark's, and it's because of this ending. I love the idea of this guy who, you know, this middle-aged man who has this job that he puts all of his energy into. He's 50 years old. He's been dating someone for 3 months now, who he'll never see again. And you don't even see him till the end. I love that we don't get a full description of Clark until Arthur's final scene. And he's kind of, you know, like this punk guy. He's got like 4 earrings in his left ear. And he has this amazing story of having been on one of the last planes to not be infected by the Georgian flu. And he basically is central to creating the new civilization.
I think you just hit something like that. He redefined himself after this ended up happening, and he found something productive to do. And we, in addition to that, we're already seeing, as civilization is reemerging, we're seeing sort of the division of labor coming in, because at some point he's allowed to run this museum and he doesn't have to go forage for food or do some of the other stuff.
And I love that, like, this is sort of a commentary on, like, why is 10% of the population gay? So one of the social science explanations of that is that you want to have a bunch of people who aren't engaged in reproduction. Hmm. And this is, and then, like, why are humans one of only four animals where women have menopause? It's that same thing. Like, you want this sort of wisdom that's not being, whose energy does not go towards reproduction of the species. And this is a great example of that. Clark's an old guy, right? Like, we're all close to 50 years old, and we don't necessarily consider ourselves old, but in the
speak for yourself, lady.
we can still imagine we have a lot of things that we're going to accomplish in our lives, and you know it. But in the post-pandemic world, I mean, you die from an infection.
Mm-hmm.
From, right? A certain point of view.
We've become the Obi-Wans. Is that what you're trying to say, Chip? That's one of my favorite things that Chip has taught us.
Luke Skywalkers.
Sometimes you're the Luke Skywalker, and sometimes you're the Obi-Wan. And Clark has become that Obi-Wan. He is that elder, that voice of this is what it was. Go forward and make something out of your world.
In fact, when he doesn't have an answer, he kind of makes up an answer. That was an interesting commentary, that sometimes he gets a question and he doesn't have all the information to be able to provide it. I don't think he's looking to deceive someone, but he is the collector. He is the librarian. He is mm-hmm. the person who is taking the wisdom of the path, or at least what he hopes is, and being able to preserve it for future generations.
And that's why I can see how Pam really enjoys this character and the anticipation of knowing Clark. We really did not get to know him until this section, where Pam knew that was her favorite character going into this thing. He is a very, very interesting character, but I think that I still enjoy the idea of Kirsten as my favorite character. She has gone through so many things, and the author is very good about explaining how the human mind is good at forgetting, and how she does not know the dark history of her own life. Her brain made it so that she forgot, and her brother said, "You don't want to know. I don't ever want you to know." And he passes away, never having explained to her the darkness of those first few, maybe years, maybe just one year, maybe, you know, and the author really tiptoes around what could have been a very dark story that really would have turned me off to her writing. But she does that so well, where we know how awful this world was. And this little girl, this darling little girl, had a really hard life for a year and a half. And then she forgot.
And she has a facial scar and she doesn't know how she got it. Mm-hmm. And she'll never know, right? And that's mm-hmm. part of the thing, is that there's no documentation that will ever be presented to her. Like, here's how it happened, which we probably would have in our society, but that is the post-pandemic world. You just have to roll with it.
And that's one of the themes, right? That is certainly mm-hmm. a theme that Emily St. John Mandel is giving us here, is the documentation of celebrity, the documentation of life. What does it mean to be a paparazzi and to trick people into getting these photographs and to sell these photographs for money? Is that meaningful? And I think the conclusion is no, it's not.
It's understandable. The mind wants to cut off what was bad. It's not helpful. It's not helpful as you move forward. And, you know, unfortunate things happen to people all the time. And if you dwelled on those unfortunate things, you know, the idea of moving forward or moving on, it just may not You know, if it's preventing you from moving on, that's one thing. But to sit there and dwell on, oh, you know, how poor this thing that happened to me really may not allow you to, you know, look at the opportunity or even survive.
How about you, Chip? Which story resonated with you?
Well, I think we have it right. Clark's story is the story that I would say, rightly so, was just fascinating. I enjoyed his story because his story was a person who accepted that the bad things happened, and then he chose to redefine himself based on that information. And I think that there's a lot to be said on how people who are going to survive are going to have to do it. I'm thinking of the movie, the book, The Giver? I'm trying to think of, there was a book that was basically a gentleman who was in the concentration camp. It's a young adult book. And he was in the concentration camp. And he said, I knew when the people were going to die because they gave up. Mm-hmm. And he was able to survive because there was little things that he did to remind that he is a human. These are things that are happening and I'm moving forward. And it allowed him to write this book. Mm-hmm. And so I think Clark was a person who, you know, accepted reality of the situation and then chose to figure out where he was going to fit into that place. And the museum that he created, creating a new life, using the airport as his city, and then how he interacted with people and how he was able to communicate with those around him. I thought that was pretty powerful. He was the helper, Steve. That was Mr. Rogers. You know, when bad things happen, look for the helper. Clark was a helper.
I would not equate Clark with the Mr. Rogers teacher as much as the librarian. He is the cultural touchstone. I don't know that he's... I wouldn't quantify him as the helper in this story. He is the one who coordinates stuff. So that's a degree of helping.
But Chip, another story that you had mentioned you liked before, which I love too, is Jivan's story. And I love that we just return to Jivan really briefly here at the end. And we find that he's now married. He has two little kids, a four-year-old and a baby. And we watch him save someone's life. And then he's making bread while his wife is taking care of the baby. And so there's something really like domestic and sustaining, but also really meaningful. Like Jivan felt like he didn't have a meaningful life before the pandemic. And now he's like the doctor for his area. And he's a really devoted father and husband.
So species is going to survive because of people like Jivan. Making bread certainly could be any type of allegory for, you break bread with friends, bread's the sustenance of life. It's the building block. He's got to be a father, but also he's active in the community. And when he got questioned about, you know, are you a doctor? He said, no. But the guy's panicking. He is, but, you know, I've trained the best I can. And he had to make a call on, do we pull out this bullet or not? Mm-hmm. And, you know, he basically explained why he's not going to do that. I mean, these are all the little touches that makes the story so wonderful and satisfying.
Yeah, that old West doctor, that old stereotype of this is the, you know, older man, usually, except for Dr. Quinn, medicine woman, who happens to have this knowledge that everybody around the area knows you go to this doctor. They are the ones who can help. There's your helper. There's your go-to.
Well, this was I had a revelation a number of years ago. I took the family on a vacation. We went to Williamsburg, Virginia, and we're taking a walk through this town. And it was explained to me, you know, we had doctors and then you had the pharmacist / surgeon. So, you know, the white collar person would be the doctor and the blue collar was the person who's like sawed your arm off and, you know, gave you leeches and all, you know, pulled your teeth and all those other things. You know, Jivan is, you know, the equivalent of that that, you know, he's the working doctor. He's, mm-hmm. he's the working person of that area. So, I mean, it makes a lot of sense.
Now, one of the questions that came up in Jivan's section gets echoed later when we get to Clark. And it's a question I'm really fascinated by. In this post-pandemic world, to what degree should they be teaching the kids history, right? Like, to what degree should they tell people about all of the creature comforts, the technology, life expectancy differences before and after this, you know, world-altering pandemic? And I think that's just such a fascinating question. And it resonates so much with questions about how we teach history today.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we've got the Georgia Guidestones to really help us out.
Different Georgia. That's the other Georgia. Not the Georgia flu Georgia. The other Georgia.
And for those who missed that, you know, esoteric reference, go to Wikipedia, look up Georgia Guidestones. And it's this mysterious guidestone that gives what we should do if something like a pandemic where the race cease to exist.
Yeah. After the apocalypse, what to do? There's in set in stone, there's instructions for what to do if there's an apocalypse.
Yeah. That is interesting. Just go back in ancient knowledge. You know, we've got a lot of information about Rome. We've got a lot of information about Greece. But you start getting back Egypt and beyond, you know, we may not be able to read what has been left for us.
That is certainly part of it.
Those things are lost history. They're mm-hmm. lost to us. And is it helpful or not? Yeah.
Because it's in cursive and the kids can't read cursive.
Well. but this question of, you know, like, to what degree do you let people know that there's been a decline in the expectations that they might have of their life? And that's a really legitimate question, I think, today, you know, as we are in this interesting moment where we've had such increases in our life expectancy, in our wealth, in our health. And now there is a concern that we might be facing a bit of a decline. I mean, 2020 was the first year that American life expectancy went down.
Mm-hmm.
But there was just an article saying 130 years could be the new norm for life expectancy. You know, the standard American diet certainly isn't helping. But mm-hmm. For those, I mean, there is a talk about us actually extending life. And the question I would have even that is, what quality of life would you have if you've been around people who are, say, 100 years?
And what access will the average person have to life-extending technologies? But I think this sort of, I feel like Emily St. John Mandel is kind of tapping into this anxiety that people in our generation have, which is like, what if our children's lives aren't better than ours? Right. I mean, I think it's a concern that people have. And I think she's tapping into that. Then how much do you tell people of the past if you end up with a situation like that?
It's so well presented here because mm-hmm. it is a big question mark. If there is no opportunity for these old things to come back, if television and the internet, they focused on the internet again in this
yes.
section, talking about the magic that was the internet, that it was everywhere, that it was ubiquitous. And if that is not within the realm of possibility that it's going to come back, do we even share that with this next generation? Do we focus on what they need now versus what we used to be able to do? That's a question of historians forever.
Well, in this story, though, I mean, the internet was magic. And for a young person, they have no concept of it.
Right.
They would have no concept of, like, what do you mean you could go to a screen and you could ask a question and all of a sudden you would know how to make bread?
Mm-hmm.
Or you'd have somebody demonstrate the technique of how to make the bread.
And that's where Kirsten has that moment that we talked about last week where she's like, oh my goodness, why didn't people look up things about science when they had the opportunity? Because here she has all of these questions and there's really no way to find the answers. And it used to be that we all had all the answers right at our fingertips, but we didn't have those questions.
Mm-hmm. Matching up the questions with the answers is a great theme that goes on with this. We, the readers, don't know the things we don't know. And when we meet Clark at the end here, we get to know so much more of the backstory as a result of having the questions. Who is Clark? How did he get here? How did this airport, this community, this city grow? And it's so well put together.
And don't underestimate this anxiety of, you know, we live in this modern society is about specialization. So each of us specializes in something, and you've got your little bit of knowledge about what you know. And, you know, some things are more specialized than others. So, but you know, if a pandemic happens on this level or something that wipes out civilization, those people who have a lot of general knowledge, all of a sudden, you know, the person who knows how to plow a field, which you may have never done, becomes very powerful in your area. Or the person who's got medicine, you know, the idea of how to use plants as medicine. You know, you could say that's specialized medicine, but I mean, specialized information, but really, it's just a person who's got a lot of general information. I know how to cook. I know how to harvest. I know how to plant. You know, lots and lots of things. All of a sudden, your bit of knowledge of how to, I don't know, pull something off an encyclopedia that's on the web just doesn't become as useful. And so that becomes, I mean, certainly, rightfully so, the anxiety of some of these type books.
But I love that Clark, who we all enjoyed, I mean, his expertise was in writing 360-degree reports of CEOs. And so he doesn't have that kind of generalized knowledge. And yet he has the kind of critical thinking skills that make him actually be a powerful figure in the new world. So I love that she does both of those things, right? She acknowledges that certain skills are more valuable than others, but she's also like, but let's not lose our artists. Let's not assume that we can move forward without our Shakespearean troupe.
Well, and, all right. So in this last section, we're introduced to two competing ideologies right here. The arts remain, right? We have the Shakespeare musicians who are still traveling around. And then we have this group of people who are zealots of religion. Mm-hmm. And you know, they're looking to survive, but certainly they're also looking to control.
Yeah. The prophet.
Yeah, and what a twist. Spoilers, everyone. What a twist that the economy of characters leads us to the prophet is a character that we knew from the beginning of this story, or nearly the beginning of this story, huh?
Yeah.
I love that twist.
And I'm really, again, as we think about how Mandel sets up, especially this final part, I'm just so impressed by the different perspectives she gives us. So I think it's really fascinating that we have our big characters that we've had their perspectives all the way through. Then in this final part, we have a little section by the clarinet. We go right into the clarinet's perspective for 4 or 5 pages. And she's the woman who's disappeared. And people are like, was she kidnapped or did she commit suicide? We found this note that sort of looked like possibly a suicide note, but it's dated from like 6 months ago. So we don't know what to do with it. And then we briefly go into the clarinet's perspective. Did you guys like this section?
Very much. I love the way that she gives us the little puzzle pieces. Again, this is not a mystery. This is not a detective fiction, but it certainly follows that format where we get the little tiny clue about this particular person's life.
Right. And we find out, like, she was their best hunter. She had lived by herself in the woods for 3 years right after the pandemic. And so she's fine. She's like a survivor. She's okay. And she had been planning to write a play. And she wrote this line as a potential opening line for her play. And then she could never think of anything else to write. And so that document that got interpreted as a possible suicide note that's got everyone thinking, how did I not see the signs, was actually a piece of art, totally unfinished. And so there's something so it's like so real about that.
Mm-hmm.
It was a dark and stormy evening.
Exactly.
I have taken a creative writing course.
And text out of context, right? When you find text that's out of context, sometimes you don't know. Now, I was fascinated that Mandel chose to give us the clarinet's perspective for a little bit, but the one perspective she never, ever gives us is Tyler's.
Mm-hmm.
So Tyler, spoiler alert, who is in fact the prophet, we see him from lots and lots of other perspectives. Arthur thinks about his son. Clark thinks about him after the pandemic because, of course, they were on the same plane. Clark has some serious anxieties about this kid who's like reading the Book of Revelations to a plane full of dead people and who's, you know, really, really struggling in the new world. And I find it interesting and sort of, I don't know, concerning, I guess, that in the couple or 3 days right after everyone's at the airport, I mean, Tyler's just on his Nintendo.
Mm-hmm. So he
doesn't interact with anyone. And then once the power goes out, he's not equipped at all to deal with the world. And, you know, we look at our children today and their reliance on online communities, online activities.
Especially in the last 16 months, especially exactly. in our pandemic, that reliance, what is it going to be like when those kids have to interact with each other on a personal basis? Will they be okay? Will we have to, boy, will we have groups that have to form to help those kids who are struggling? And as a result, are we going to help more kids who are struggling with these issues because we are more aware of them because of this pandemic? The before and after, you know, what sorts of things will change as a result? This is put together in such a way that we get all of those perspectives. The one perspective you forgot was the mother, the Tyler's mother, seeing this kid and kind of ignoring him and kind of trying her hardest to get back to that world that was out there, being sure, being absolutely sure that the good guys are going to come, that the military is going to roll in. We need to keep the runways clear just in case there's a plane. And her not paying attention to Tyler and what that contributes to his later obsession with finding community. Very well put together
and
character.
Controlling the community.
I think about this a little bit differently. I think what the author is showing though is there's randomness in life. You know, you're the unlucky person that gets cancer. You're the unlucky person that was in the car accident. You're the unlucky person whose business failed or something of that nature. And that's just, it's just part of life that or human experience to have those type of things. And then there's this group of people that somehow think that this is the punishment, that mm-hmm. this was directed that way. And they're looking for that there has to be a meaning behind it where it's really just, you know, life has some spontaneous and randomness to it. And it's just kind of revealed. And that's where the zealot comes in. That's where the person comes in and somehow people are listening to them and it becomes a movement. And then, you know, he has to go out. He's got to go away because he's disrupting how society can run. But obviously he gets to come back and there's death surrounding him. There's certainly control and also destruction of other humans.
Mm-hmm.
So why do you think Mandel chooses not to give us his perspective?
I think that would be a different book. I think that this book is about the community that happens around him. I think that she could write a second book that was from his perspective. Yeah, exactly. There's your face. This is good radio, Pam.
Sorry. I'm like, that's a terrible idea.
It's a terrible idea because we are not focused on that element of that zealot idea that maybe crooked thinking that is that we're watching from outside and seeing the formation of this, the idea of blind faith that he believes these things to be true is frightening. It's terrifying that he has some little piece of knowledge, and from that small little piece of knowledge he builds this whole idea. And yes, the idea of the religious zealot, the one who thinks that they know because they read this piece, not the whole body of work to understand the context.
But he gets followers. That's the other part, is that he can get followers. Mm-hmm. And they're blindly following it, and they're as thugs, and they go around and they hurt people, and they control people, and they destroy as much as they create. And the question is, do we have civilization or thugs? Who, and that is the story of history, is that thugs can come in and truly impact society in many, many ways. But somehow they've been able to create control and also insulate themselves.
And I think what Mandel is doing here, this is very consonant with her other decisions to say, Kirsten forgot everything about those first year and a half, so we're not going to talk about it. We all know how bad it was. It was really, really bad. And I think she's making the same decision here. She's like, I don't have to show you the inside of Tyler's head. You guys know, like, it's really bad. And that's not what we're going to focus on. But we have to acknowledge that those perspectives will be part of the new world, but we're going to see them from the outside. And so in a lot of ways, I think the climax of this story is the meeting of Kirsten and Tyler. Do you guys agree with that? I mean, to me, like, that meeting, right? It's basically, it's Arthur's, the two children, you know, Arthur's biological child, Tyler, who was living in Israel, and who we find out he did call on the day he died. And then Kirsten, his sort of, who's like, Arthur was a father figure to her fictional father in the King Lear production, but really a father figure because her parents are not very involved in her life. And so the meeting of these two kids, the two kids who have the two copies of the comic books that Miranda did. And I have to say, I have read this a lot of times. It still chokes me up when I read the meeting. Did you guys have that feeling as you were reading this, or am I just a very sentimental person?
No, I think you hit there. I kept thinking of Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons' Watchmen, because throughout that graphic novel, inside there are other writings, but there's also this other comic that gets continuously thrown into the story. It has nothing to do with the story. It's a story about pirates, but I mean, as you're reading it, it mirrors what's going on in real life. So it's a trope in the sense that other writers have used this, but it was just amazing, sort of the interaction between them and why they had the comic and what the story's going on, how he was asking the questions that were appropriate for her, and she was responding to it. There's a mentorship there, but it really is a loving, fatherly mentorship kind of there, as far as how they're interacting. I totally understand why it's in a very emotional period. I'm a father, and I can see how any parent interacting with a person that they care about, and trying to communicate and draw out information from them.
And how that vocabulary, those words from that particular story, become the words that Tyler internalizes and becomes this religious zealotry based on these few words, and how Kirsten recognizes those words and has that shared communication where the two of them can talk on this level, talking about these ideas in this piece of art, that is, again, a theme of this story. How art influences life from this adorable girl who really thinks that Arthur was amazing and doesn't know the link between this story and Arthur, and how then Tyler gets this link between Arthur and this story because Arthur was asking him questions about it because that's what he was interested in, and how that grows into that religious zealotry.
And then we have this situation where we find out, so Tyler basically had two books, right? And so did Kirsten. Kirsten's two books were Dear V and Station 11. Tyler's two books were The Bible and Station 11. And he read them both the same way, right? Mm. He read them both as like scriptural, this is how you should live your life. Now, we saw Miranda writing Station 11, and we know that's not why she was writing it at all. But this is how it gets interpreted. And so I think it's really fascinating that this prophet, who's clearly a danger to the new society, danger to the new civilization, you know, he's like kidnapping and marrying children. He has multiple wives. He has this feeling of himself and his thug followers as the chosen ones. You know, he's terrorizing these small communities that are just trying to get by and enjoy a little Shakespeare once or twice, you know, per year. And so, but this is his weakness is Kirsten's strength, right? Because Kirsten, like, it's about the interpretation of literature. And so I think, like, I get choked up by this moment, partly because you just have these two sort of symbolic children of Arthur meeting for the first time. They didn't know each other existed, and they will never know each other existed. Only we know. Right. And so I feel like in this meeting in the road, I love we're in Kirsten's perspective here. And when she and Arthur and Saeed are hiding, and that's really interesting too, because Saeed is her ex-boyfriend, but they're still close because even though sometimes she hates him, she still loves him. Like she only knows 30 people, right? And so it's not like he's been replaced. And August is her best friend. And so they see just her, so she has to come out. And basically, she thinks she's going to die. And I love the phrase when she comes out, she walked forward through the radiant world, the sunlight and shadow and green. She thinks of Saeed and August. She sees this boy, one of the thugs from the St. Deborah on the Water community. She sees that he's crying. He's holding a gun and he's crying. And here's what she thinks. If she could only speak to August. We traveled so far and your friendship meant everything. It was very difficult, but there were moments of beauty. Everything ends. I am not afraid. And she's thinking, August, don't you dare come out and try to save me because that's how you kill yourself. I know you can't come out. It's done. You and Saeed, you just stay in the bushes, nothing. And she's looking at this little boy. And then the prophet, this guy, she doesn't know who he is. He starts quoting Station 11. And like, this is this, like, you have copy 2 of 10 in the world. She's never in her 20 years met anyone who's ever heard of this. We've seen her asking people, you ever heard of this book? Never heard of it, right? He starts quoting the book and she quotes back, we long only to go home. We dream of sunlight. We dream of walking on earth. The prophet's expressionless was unreadable. Did he recognize the text? And she goes on, we have been lost for so long. We long only for the world we were born into. This is what Miranda was writing 20 years ago. But it's too late for that, the prophet said. He drew in his breath and adjusted his grip on the rifle. The shot was so loud that she felt the sound in her chest, a thud by her heart. And it's not the prophet who shoots. It's the boy who kills the prophet. So the only way we can have the prophet's death is in this moment where his misinterpretation of Miranda's text is corrected by his follower, who then tragically, this little boy kills himself and Kirsten's like, no, and she's too slow. And so this moment where she's all planning to sacrifice herself for her friends and this little boy sacrifices himself for them. For civilization, mm-hmm. continuation of this small piece of Southern Ontario and Northern Michigan. Sorry, I'm talking way too long, but it's just it's an amazing climax to this book where like everything comes together.
Everything comes together is the point that I wanted to make, because again, this is not a mystery, but the puzzle of how this all comes together is beautifully done, so well presented here, and we go on this journey with all of these different people, so many different journeys in so many different directions, and all of the journeys wind up in one spot, and it's phenomenal.
Yeah.
And I love that August is looking through the prophet's bag. And like, you guys, like right away, these people, they have this gunfire, this like gunfight in the middle of the road. And what do? You take the dead guy's stuff and see if he's got anything valuable. Like August does what people would do in this situation. And he finds a page from Station 11. And then Kirsten looks at this page. She's never seen another copy of her favorite book, right? And she thinks, who were you? How did you come to possess this page? Kirsten knelt by the prophet, by the pool of his blood. But he was just another dead man on another road, answerless, the bearer of another unfathomable story about walking out of one world and into another. One of his arms was outstretched towards her. So he's died in this kind of gesture toward the future. She knows she'll never know. But we, the lucky reader, get to know exactly how they came to be in this moment. But, and that's so real, right?
Mm-hmm.
The fact that we never do know what's inside another person's mind, except in fiction. And it's truth, it's beauty, but it's not fact, but it's more than fact, it's truth.
Wow. This might be the best book that we've read in the 12 months of this book club, Pam. This is literature level.
This is a great book, and it's worthy of rereading.
Mm-hmm. As Pam has done many times.
Well, and as I try to skim it, and then I can't do it, and I just reread it again and again. I know.
It comes to an end, though, Pam. Like most things, this book comes to an end. And did you like the ending of this one?
Hated it. I guess stood up. Of course I liked the ending of this one. You know, and I love that the last chapter is in three sections. And we actually accompany Arthur on his last day. And we find out all of the interesting things he did. He thought about calling Clark, didn't. Thought about calling Tyler, didn't. He doesn't know he's on his last day on Earth. And he tells Tanya, his, you know, young new lover, that he's going to pay off her student loans, $47,000. And he'll never get a chance to do that. And it won't matter. And so I just kind of love that, like, being in the mind of someone who doesn't realize they're in their last day. But then...
I was going to say, isn't that the reminder, though? That
totally,
every interaction could be your final interaction. Every moment could be the last time you interact with something.
Yeah.
Would that change how you interact with anyone?
And how beautiful is it that we started with Arthur at the beginning of the book and we end with Arthur at the end, and it's actually the day before the end. So there's that not time travel element of time travel here as well.
Life is a stage, Steve. Life is a stage.
We just the players.
And so it's interesting that we saw Jeevan watching Arthur die and thinking it's so weird that there's snow falling, fake snow on the stage. And now we see Arthur, who realizes, whoa, it's my heart. And he sees the man from the front row was running now. That's Jeevan. And Arthur was in motion too. He fell against a pillar and began to slide. And now snow was falling all around him, shining in the lights. He thought it was the most beautiful thing he'd ever seen. That's the last we're going to see of Arthur. And Jeevan had that same feeling, right? Like that the snow is really beautiful. And I think there's something about that, this notion of snow, which of course is connected to climate crisis and to these anxieties about how the world is changing. And this sense, like that's such a Canadian thing. The most beautiful thing about Canada is the snow. all the time. This is in Toronto. And so he's delighted to see snow at the end of his life.
And you pointed out the word beauty and beautiful is one of the most used words in this story. It is used 54 times.
Wow, that's more than I would have guessed, but it's a lot. Yeah, wow.
That idea of finding the beauty in the normal, in the everyday, in the average, I found the idea of the improbability of all of these things, all of this stuff that we take for granted every day, it is totally improbable that this exists. The internet is completely madness. The fact that somebody somewhere in a room decided that we should make the World Wide Web. Tim Berners-Lee, by the way, is his name. He invented the World Wide Web one day sitting in his office, and here we are, you know, 20, 30 years later, talking to each other on a video phone. The improbability of all of these things coming together is a great theme in this story.
Right, and so, as Bill Gates told us, we needed air conditioning before we could invent the computers to create the web that connects us all together. I mean, all of these pieces. I love that, Steve.
That would be James Burke's connection series they had from a long, long time ago. But okay. I was thinking about snow and how snow kind of covers up the ugliness of life. And for that brief moment, there is a beauty because it is clean and it's virgin. It's has untouched, and there's any ability of future that could come from that.
And so in the final chapter, we go to a section of Dr. 11, just a little piece that we hadn't read before. And it looks exactly like the place that Miranda worked when she worked in Toronto. And Captain Lonigan, Dr. Eleven's sidekick, has been assassinated. And Dr. Eleven says, "What was it like for you at the end?" Captain Lonigan, "It was exactly like waking up from a dream." And I think this is one of the themes, right, of sort of apocalyptic literature, is we get immersed in these stories and then we have the revelation. So we have to wake up from the novel as from a dream and be like, what did I learn from that? Mm-hmm. And so I think she's kind of telling us exactly what we've been talking about the whole time. Like, what do you learn from this book? And it's like quite a lot.
And what do you learn from our pandemic? What do you learn exactly as a result of the befores and the afters? Is that memory equatable to dream? You know, how the human mind works, the idea of the memories is just this pattern of electrons in your brain. And you can go and relive those moments because they are saved in a format that you can access until you can't. And then you can't access those memories. And that is just wiped out on a rotating basis. You know, do you remember things from 20 years ago? Some things are very important.
But they're not even reality, though, at that point. Our memories are terrible. They are our feelings, or maybe that's how it was told to you. It could be anything, but to trust your memory. That may not be the place to go.
And then whether it's that we can't remember the words to REM's song, or that we can't remember like much more important elements of our lives, like trauma. So then in the very final scene, we end up with Clark's perspective. And Kirsten has given him one of the books to keep in the Museum of Civilization. And of course, as a library lover, I'm like, oh, good job, Kirsten. You preserve the document. Like, make sure you do that. And I just want to say before we leave Kirsten to turn to Clark, I loved the whole section about her knife tattoos and how they represent the people she's killed. And when François Diallo asks her, why didn't you want to talk about that? Like, a lot of people have these knife tattoos that represent the people they've killed. She's like, I don't want it written down. This isn't something I want a document of. The document is on my body. Then the men that I have killed, and she specifically says they're men. The three men, there she has two men. When she gets to the airport, she's like, who knows a tattooist? I need another knife. The three men she's killed, she carries with her every day. She says that's the biggest difference before the pandemic and after. It's not being afraid. It's killing. It's just being an ordinary person who sometimes has to kill. It's an amazing perspective.
Well, and isn't that the difference between modern society, typically, for most of us, and then a society? Well, I shouldn't even say that. You know, there are brutal areas, even in the United States, where
there are brutal
killing
lives.
I mean, Chicago, killing happens far more than most of us would be comfortable with.
Mm-hmm. That's a part of so many people's lives, that brutality. Yes, you're right. Our lifestyle, we don't think about whether we're going to go and kill someone today. We don't think about somebody killing us, hopefully, today. But there are lots of people around the world where that brutality is daily. That's normal. That's common. And seeing that in the perspective of this adorable little girl who grows up to be this very strong character, and hearing how she feels that is a part of who she is. That's the history. That's the documentation. That is all of those themes that we've built up in this story.
It's the Old West in many ways, right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'm sorry, the American West, as we like to think about it.
But I love that. So that fact of killing, which is a part of this life, she wants to document on her body, and it dies with her. But the Station 11 comic, she wants in the library where other people can see and read it. And you guys, it just became a ton more important to the history of the world by being this seminal text in the killing of the prophet, who was such a threat to the way of life. And so she says, I'll give you one book. I'm off, because, oh my goodness, we can see electric lights 20 years later from the top of the tower. So what is happening? We're going to go exploring in a new area. And when I come back, she says to Clark, I'll switch you novels. So I've got two books, I'll switch you up. So there's always one of them at the museum. And so Kirsten goes off to bed, and Clark opens the book. And as soon as he opens it, and he doesn't know how in the world she even got this, he realizes this was written by Miranda. This is the dinner party that I was at, where Arthur left Miranda for Elizabeth. And he sees himself. He sees like a cartoon representation of himself and all the other people. The pretentious woman who said Prague with a funny accent. And the only person missing is Miranda herself. And she's replaced by Dr. Eleven, which kind of suggests to us, like, the author is always present. And it makes you wonder, like, who's Emily St. John Mandel, right? Does she see herself as Kirsten? Or as Arthur,
or as Clark,
and or as Clark, you know, like, where is she present? Because, or as Dr. Eleven, like, is so it's a wonderful, I think, metafictional moment.
So what we have is society is moving on. We've got electricity again, right? So we're getting progress. And then we got this moment where, I mean, she really does. The author is just wrapping this up in such a lovely, lovely way. Man, yes.
Back to that idea of the specialization. Somebody who's left alive knows how to make electricity. Somebody who's left alive could find a way to generate electricity. And we have this on the horizon, literally, this civilization that has electricity. And what's going to come of that civilization as a result of that electricity? It's so well put together, where we have to think about the future in this story of history.
So we end the novel with Clark, who's now 70 years old. He's quite frail, but in reasonably good health for a man who's lived 20 years past the pandemic. He's just read this story and he's thinking, how in the world did this 28-year-old woman end up with Miranda's novel? Little does he know, but we know, that the other thing in Kirsten's backpack that she didn't even show him is the paperweight that he gave Arthur and Miranda for their wedding some 35 years earlier. And so I just love that detail, that Kirsten's the one who ends up with the paperweight, and she thinks it's so beautiful, but Arthur doesn't know that. So He's in his airport. He's in his new Museum of Civilization, previously known as the Sky Miles Lounge. He had no expectation of seeing an airplane rise again in his lifetime. But is it possible that somewhere there are ships setting out? If there are again towns with streetlights, if there are symphonies and newspapers, then what else might this awakening world contain? Perhaps vessels are setting out even now, traveling toward or away from him, steered by sailors armed with maps and knowledge of the stars, driven by need or perhaps simply by curiosity. Whatever became of the countries on the other side? If nothing else, it's pleasant to consider the possibility. He likes the thoughts of ships moving over the water toward another world, just out of sight. The end.
Bravo. Good job.
We're left with this very reflective, you know, is it time to start wondering what other people are doing? Because for the past 20 years, we've just been surviving. Survival is insufficient. Is it time to reconnect, but in a new way, a different way?
And the metaphor of travel and the metaphor of life and the path that we take through life. Are we ships that are moving out of sight? There's a beautiful metaphor there to the civilization and the path that we are on. Wonderful.
So yay, thank you for reading this book with me. It's been so much fun to talk about it with you guys, and it's just been such a pleasure to have like a shared appreciation for such a gorgeously constructed text.
And I think this is one that we have agreed upon more than most of the texts that we've read, that we all got something different out of this story. And the author is very, very open to putting in all of these different ideas that we can see it from our different perspectives. There's that word again. And we can get something special out of it. So Pam, what's our assignment for next week?
Well, you guys, it's been 1 year of this awesome book club and I've had so much fun, but we are past the pandemic, my friends. Ish, maybe.
Ish, sort of.
Let's assume in some sense.
There's a Delta going on.
Oh, and
Delta
I just,
means change, right?
You know, and now I just get this report out of Canada that they're very worried about the Lambda variant. And I was like, wait a minute, there's a lot of letters between Delta and Lambda. I don't know exactly how many, but a bunch. Yeah. And now Lambda's a concern. But either way, let us end with hope for today. So guys, I think our next job is to do a wrap up of this 1 year that we've spent reading books together.
It's amazing, isn't it, that you agreed to share this book club with us a year ago, and I was very hesitant. I said, Pam, would you do a book club with us for like a full year? Can you commit to a full year? Because I know you're a busy, wonderful professor who knows so many things and is willing to share with us, but you shared with us so many great ideas in the last year. So we need to do a little wrap up. We need to do a little put a bow on the end of this book club. So our assignment for next week, and everybody out there, I want you to join us. What is your favorite things from the last 12 months? What have you learned as a result of all of this information? We would love to hear about your favorite moments. If you've got a favorite clip, something that we said that was particularly wonderful, we would love to hear that. Which was your favorite book out of all of these books that we've read? Your favorite topic? Your favorite theme, and your favorite new word. We've learned so much vocabulary in the last 12 months. What was your favorite of this whole endeavor? We would love to hear from you. I don't know, Chip. I think we have enough information to survive another week. What do you think?
Only if we can come back next week.
What do you think, Pam?
Absolutely. Excited to hear what we have to share.
I look forward to an interesting conversation about all of our interesting conversations from the last 12 months. Again, we would love to hear from you. If you have something that you found incredibly interesting or frustrating in our show for the last 12 months, we would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-410-4867. Send us an email, sandwiches@irregularhours@gmail.com. Our website is sandwiches@irregularhours.com. We're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. We're on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and YouTube. I want to thank you again for listening to Sandwiches at Irregular Hours. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenblum.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
We'll see you in the future.